forgiveness. It is at the heart of the Christian message, by which I mean, not only did God send his Christ to reconcile us to God's self, I mean, that's the easy part, at least for us, not so much for Jesus, but that we too are to forgive others as we ourselves have been forgiven. And that is not quite so easy, is it? In addition to the hurts and the resentments, and yes, sometimes the permanent damage that the sins of others have inflicted upon us, we live in a culture which exists in an uneasy relationship with the very concept of forgiveness. The truth is, we can make a hit series out of a TV show called Revenge. We like to see the perpetrators pay. The truth is that I cannot imagine forgiveness as a viable option in the toolkit of our diplomats. I mean, when was the last time a political or international antagonist suggested forgiveness as a way of resolving a grudge? And even in the smaller orbit of our own personal lives, our marriages, our employments, our friendships, what we allow to pass for forgiveness is so pale an imitation of the gospel imperative as to be almost laughable. You know what I mean. All those little tricks by which we keep a relationship going without actually putting to rest or forgiving the hurts that we nurse. Letting our anger leak into private little mutterings unheard by the offender. Quasi-successful attempts to forget or to just stop thinking about an offense as a way of loosening its hold on us. Sugarcoating a past that wasn't really all that great. You know, the not-so-good good old days. Convincing ourselves that whatever it wasn't really all that big a deal. After all, if there's nothing to forgive, then forgiveness isn't an issue. Well, I say balderdash. My guess is, based on our average age, if nothing else, that there are very few people in this room who have not at one time or another been irrevocably damaged by the action or inaction of another, who have never had to struggle with the meaning and the practice of forgiveness. The forgiveness which Jesus models, the forgiveness which the gospel asks of us, will not settle for these half measures and pretenses. Because true forgiveness, at least in hard cases, is a costly, costly act. Because it requires us to live into our soreness, our anger, our sense of betrayal, and to allow that experience somehow to transform us. True forgiveness is not for the faint of heart. But we may take heart in the fact that it is seldom, I would say almost never, effected in a single magnanimous moment, swooshing, "It's all right, I forgive you. You ruined my life, but it's okay." Right, you get it, don't you? The kind of forgiveness of which I am speaking is a sometimes years-long journey. It's less a declaration in time than a gradual conversion of heart. The author and theologian Stephen Cherry sees forgiveness not as something that we do so much as a state of being. He speaks more of forgivingness than of forgiveness itself, if that makes sense. He says this. It's a long sentence, so I'll try and parse it into manageable clauses, but come with me, because it's important. He says, any duty regarding forgiveness is best understood not as a requirement to forgive come what may, so much as the challenge to engage with whatever life throws at us with a forgiving heart, and to allow ourselves to be drawn into the spiritual struggle and the healing agony, which is honest about hurt and hopeful about overcoming the emotional and spiritual damage inflicted by others. The healing agony, that is in fact the name of his book. And you can hear the double entendre, the healing of agony, but also the agony that heals. And Cherry is especially concerned with what we might call the hard cases, torture, the murder of children, terrorism, and so on. And he maps out a helpful model for understanding this journey towards forgiveness. And he really does envisage it as a map. He, in a kind of Bunyan-esque way, he geographitizes. I just made that word up. It's great, isn't it? He geographitizes the experience of forgiveness. So at the center of the map, right in the center, is what he calls the wilderness of hurt. And it's surrounded on all sides by what is named the river of distasteful empathy. Now, when we are first violated, we live in the center, in this wilderness of hurt. And maybe that's the time when nothing much else can be happening but that you are recovering from the acute damage, from the acute pain, from your physical and emotional destruction. And if you're lucky, it's a time when people are gathered around you, when they haven't forgotten that this happened to you yet, and they offer you their support. But it's a terrible place to live. You don't want to live there. And Cherry envisages a better place. Now, it's no paradise, because he isn't so naive as to think that we can ever turn back the clock on these hard cases and act as if nothing ever happened. Something happened. But it's certainly less barren a place than the wilderness of hurt. Things can actually grow there. So it's a desirable place to attain. The difficulty is that between the wilderness of hurt and that new land is the river of distasteful empathy. And what that means is that we must enter empathetically into the reality of the perpetrator, trying to understand what makes him or her tick, his motives, her upbringing. And he's quick to point out that this isn't so that we can give the perpetrator a pass, so we can hand out excuses, but rather so that we can cease to demonize this person. We can begin to see her is actually another human being. And it's tough, as he says, distasteful work. Because you know what? there are certain consolations that come along with being the wronged one, such as the sympathy of other people and bragging rights to righteous indignation. Nevertheless, it's not until we have relinquished our identity as victim that we can be free from the power of the perpetrator over our souls, to be inhabiting our imagination and catching our attention at all times of the day and night. It's not until we have unlocked the perpetrator from the festering chamber in our hearts where we keep him or her imprisoned. And we don't just do that for ourselves and our own sense of well-being, because neither can the perpetrator be released so long as we hold the keys to our own hearts. I'm not saying it's easy. And so I close with a prayer that recognizes that many of us aren't there yet. Coincidentally, because we spoke about this person earlier this morning, it was written by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, a man who has his own credentials when it comes to forgiveness, a protagonist for justice in unjust South Africa, a protagonist for forgiveness in the face of so much unforgiveness, and yet an honest assessor of his own heart. And it is entitled, The Prayer Before the Prayer. It goes like this. Lord, I want to be willing to forgive, but I dare not ask for the will to forgive in case you give it to me and I am not yet ready. I am not yet ready for my heart to soften. I am not yet ready to be vulnerable again, not yet ready to see that there is humanity in my tormentor's eyes, or that the one who hurt me may also have cried. I am not yet ready for the journey. I am not yet interested in the path. I am at the prayer before the prayer of forgiveness. Grant me the will to want to forgive. Grant it to me, not yet, but soon. Amen. My friends, I think it's all right as long as we're on the journey.